The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, January 30th, 2009. This is episode number 162, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today, bringing you the best in MotoGP coverage on the podcast world, or whatever it is, the pod place. So, what do we got going on today? Jules and I have a big call, part three of our season review for 2008. It's interesting stuff. We cover the Stoner Surge, which was the British Grand Prix at Donington, the Assen TT at Assen in the Netherlands, and the Deutsche Motorrad Grand Prix at Sachsenring in Germany. So we're covering Britain, Netherlands, and Germany, the races there. That is the Stoner Surge in the middle of the season there. Some interesting stuff. I think Jules and I did a super good call. It was a lot of fun to do, and hopefully it'll be a lot of fun for you guys to listen to. Let's see. Before we get to that call, we got an administrative note or three to take care of. First of all, big shout-out, giant thank you to speedfiends.com. They were kind enough to donate to the MotoGPOD cause, help pay for bandwidth, help pay for the hosting and Skype bills and beer bill and all that kind of stuff that goes into making a podcast. And you should check them out. This is Speed Fiends Cycle. And their website is Speed and then Fiends, FEENZ.com, SpeedFiends.com. And they have a nice store going on, and they have some great deals on a lot of the usual stuff, let's face facts. So things you can buy, helmets, jackets, gloves, all that kind of stuff that you might want as a motorcyclist. It's kind of a cool site. You can pay with PayPal. They have some other stuff. So check it out, speedfiends.com. Of course, there will be a link on the MotoGPOD website to that. And thank you very much again for that donation. And now while we're talking about links and things like that, it is getting very close to the start of the season here. Well, I guess the MotoGP season doesn't start till April, so that's still a ways out. But World Superbike starts in like 4 weeks, folks, March 1st. So we only have to get through February, and then we've got World Superbike. So we're getting very close to having some, you know, world-class motorcycle road racing action going on. March 1st, World Superbike's going to be down there in Australia at Phillip Island. So I'm looking forward to that. That's good stuff. MotoGP, we wait till April 12th for their first race at Qatar. But it's all good stuff. So you might be planning, though, your packages to go to a MotoGP round. And if you're thinking about that, I've got two websites that I'm going to point you in the direction of. Now, because our audience listenership here is largely United States, roughly about 50%, which is, you know, it actually is kind of amazing that 50% of it is international, but whatever, about 50% U.S., we're going to talk first about if you're going to Laguna Seca or Indy, check out powersportdynamic.com. Again, going to be a link on the website, motogpod.com. Go there, look for the link. You're looking for powersportdynamic.com. This is Rexine Wall. They've got a chalet at Turn 5 at Laguna Seca. I believe they're setting something up for Indy, although I don't have a lot of details on that. But go to their website if you want a fantastic deal on a good race package for Laguna Seca, which is going to be in July, the July 4th weekend. Check it out, powersportdynamic.com. We're going to have Rexine on the show here soon. I've already talked to her a little bit. We just haven't finalized all of the details and all of that. She's going to give us some more information about exactly what's included in all of this. But if you want to check it out now, ahead of time, just kind of jump in the gun. If you want a great way to go spend your July 4th weekend at Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, check out powersportdynamic.com. And the next thing is if you're going to any MotoGP round, including the Laguna Seca round, and you want a just a deluxe, fantastic package, this is the uber luxury suite kind of a thing. I mean, this is fantastic stuff at an affordable, reasonable price. Check out PolePositionTravel.com. This is Gordon Howe. We've worked with him in the past. I met up with him at Laguna Seca and at Indy. He was kind enough to invite us to his Jules and I both went to his sort of Saturday evening party event things that he organizes. It was really, really great stuff. Got to see Steve Parrish telling these fantastic stories of working as a MotoGP commentator and all of that. And that was just well worth the price of admission to be able to sit in on that. And on top of that, you get, you know, the whole meal deal, tickets, paddock pass, a suite seat that you've got. You know, you've got TVs right there. You've got a great track view. You're at the track and all of that kind of stuff. Free beer, free food. It's, well, included beer, included food, all that kind of stuff. Check that one out, Pole Position Travel. Now, Pole Position Travel does every race on the calendar, folks. So if you are planning a trip to Jerez or Valencia or Qatar or any of the races on the calendar and you're interested in maybe getting a little bit of help and everything, check out Pole Position Travel, Gordon Howe. And if you're going to Laguna Seca and you want to look at that package there, that's a Power Sport Dynamic Rexine Wall. Check them out. And if you decide that you're going to proceed forward with it, just tell them that MotoGPOD sent you and everything. We're going to be working with both Gordon and Rexine. We're going to have them on the show. They're going to explain a little bit about what they can offer. It's really, really great stuff. And why don't we go ahead and talk to Jules. Jules, how are you doing today?
I am doing good, Bob. How are you?
I am also doing very, very well. Busy, busy time at work lately, keeping me from thinking about how long it's been since we had any MotoGP racing or, well, any racing, really. But,
well, we had Dakar.
We did have a Dakar. You're right. But, I mean, you know, street, you know, road course racing, MotoGP, World Superbike, even AMA, that kind
of
thing.
I'm watching a lot of DVDs of racing. Actually, cool. I have the season reviews going back to, I think, 98 Superbikes, and then I have from 2000 on, I have all the MotoGP ones. So I was looking at it. They used to actually, those reviews DVDs, the season reviews were really good because they actually squeezed in like 125s and 250s. And later on, they kind of became like these music videos, you know, and they just had like way too little material. I think their 2001 was like a 3-hour DVD, and the 2007 was like, I don't know, maybe an hour and a half.
Yeah, and it's kind of strange that, you know, since, you know, you're talking going all the way back to 98, that's like VHS type days, and sure, so they moved to DVD, where they've got, you can have so much more time and so many more features and everything, but oddly enough, the reviews get sort of shorter and less relevant or what have you, you know, well, more filled with fluff.
The 98 one was short. The World Superbike reviews were short. It was only the 2001 where it was like a 3-hour DVD. I think it was like the first year they did it on DVD.
Yeah, they're probably finding that it just, you know, they spent a lot of money to master the DVD and to put it all together and everything, and it just, maybe they just didn't have the numbers of sales. I don't think that they sell enormous quantities of those.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, and they should. So, and now with the internet and everybody's getting, we're going to have all of our video and entertainment and everything is just going to come straight to your computer, right? So, but unfortunately, they make it difficult.
Yeah. The people who watch Hulu at the local coffee bar, I'm trying to do work.
Oh, yeah. you know, I don't think I've ever once logged onto Hulu. I don't know. I'm still of the mindset. I like TV on TV, and I'll, you know, okay, I can look at YouTube and stuff. I don't sort of have the attention span to watch like an entire show on the computer. It just, like, I don't know. Screen? I get distracted, and next thing, it's not just the screen. It's just the fact that, you know, the computer does so many other things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'll see something in the show, and next thing you know, I'm on Wikipedia, and I've blown an hour, you know.
Wikipedia
sounds like
evil.
A day at work.
Yeah.
So, well, why don't we stop going on about that and start talking about last year, continuing our season review of 2008. As you will recall, our last couple of shows, we started off with Qatar, Spain, and Portugal. So, or as we were talking about last night, it was Qatar, Jerez, and Estoril. And then we last show, we did China, France, Italy, and Catalonia.
Which was so the Rossi Resurgence.
Rossi section. Resurgence, yes. Lorenzo show started off the first three races, then we had the Rossi Resurgence.
And then we're going to have the Stoner Surge.
The Stoner Surge.
This is the three races that like brought Stoner back from the dead. I don't think too many people were really considering him out of the running, but it seemed like it was going to be impossible for him to be a contender with Pedrosa as strong as he has been. I mean, he had just come off a win at Catalunya and pulled back the points to Valentino Rossi. You know, they're like, you know, 40, almost 40 points ahead of, well, no, they're 43 points ahead of Stoner at that point.
Right, right. It was looking, you know, there was a significant difference, but this all boils down, and we said this last year, that, you know, how much the point system awards winning. It very much awards consistency, but it really awards, like, consistency on the podium.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get like, one chance. You know, you have your one shot a year where you can crash or something like that, and you might still be okay, but other than that, you've got to be in the top, well, top five, certainly the top three, really, so...
Yeah, definitely, and it's not like Stoner has been completely invisible. I mean, he had a pole position at Catalunya, and he also had some very good qualifyings in general. Just that he had those two tracks that he really had trouble with.
Right, Jerez, he got only 5 points, and then no points at all in France. So
yep.
Yeah,
yep. So he had that nasty French result, and then also then he had to go to Italy, you know.
Yeah.
Where he did and, the and best for, of it that he could.
Yeah, with the Ducati pressure and all of that, and I mean he didn't get a lot of points at Estoril mm-hmm. either. So you know he'd had basically three races that were sort of out of the money kind of a thing, and right. That was not good. So in any case, so Donington.
Yeah, Donington. England. Donington. We had Stoner was. It was, I think, a different weather every day. It's like pouring down wet the first day, I believe, and he was the fastest. And it was like dry the second day, and he was the fastest. And then I think the race day came, and it was kind of mixed weather. And
right.
and he won the race by, I think, like 6 or 7 seconds. Let me see what was the
5.7.
Gap. 5.7, yeah, but that was probably because of the wheelie at the end.
possibly, exactly. And, yeah, I mean, the qualifying session was officially classed as wet, but, yeah, if I recall, it was sort of wet and dry, one of those kind of oddball conditions, but also quite cold.
Yes, it was very cold.
Yeah. It's June in England, so, you know, what do you expect? It's going to be cold and wet, right?
right.
So,
important thing was, of course, also here that Caparossi broke his hand in Catalunya. We had a replacement rider for him, which was Ben Spies, who was, you know, not really set up to run until Indy. No, sorry, until Laguna Seca. But they flew him out to Donington, and he replaced Caparossi for that race.
Right. Ended up qualifying eighth, which is
pretty damn good.
Pretty damn good, realistically. I mean, you know, first time out and all of that, and it's such a different deal.
I mean, he's never been to this track.
Yeah, finished at the points. Yeah, new to the track and all that. Finished in the points, didn't set the world on fire or anything like that. And if I recall, we also had a discussion with Liam that was, you know, because we were all sort of saying, you know, what a stellar performance by Spies. And Liam was somewhat saying, you know, it really wasn't. And I'm still not 100% sure I buy into that. I thought Liam made excellent points, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just captivated by the whole, you know, wow, you know, kid gets called up to the bigs and you know, hits one out of the park kind of a thing, you know. So, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, Vermeulen finished way ahead of him, so I don't know. It was really his – he did get – one of the things that I think Spies had that most new riders – quote rookies, whatever, don't have, because he's not really a rookie in this season. He's a wild card rider. Is because he's a wild card rider. He was able to test at Indy when they were first testing
that's
the
true.
New layout,
right? Right. So when Nicholas Canepa, yeah,
exactly. And he did quite well over there. So I think our expectations were already set that he was not going to just have. It wasn't going to be his first time out on the MotoGP bike. He actually did get at speed. testing quite a lot of it at Indy.
Yeah, and that certainly helps.
It's 2 or 3 days, so still. I mean,
right. You know, he gets some time on the bike. He gets to meet the team. He, you know, a few things. So it's a little bit less of a shock. But I still, still thought it was a fairly respectable performance, considering that beat Melandri on roughly the same equipment. You know, I mean, which.
One could argue that if he beat Melandri, and Melandri was in better equipment, because that equipment that Melandri was on won the race.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. good point. So, what am I thinking? why did I say that? You're right. Melandri was on much better equipment, and Melandri the veteran and all of that. So, that's somewhat telling right there. But of course, Melandri had that season is an anomaly. I'm sure that Melandri would like to forget it.
And I think a lot of people would like to forget it.
Yeah, it was so bizarre. We probably Ducati. Devote a whole show to that. You know, the whole Marco Melandri meltdown thing. Just it was bizarre. Sad to see. So,
Vermeulen had a good qualifying. I think this is the first time he was in the front row. But other than that, was the usual guys. Hayden, of course, does well, and he got to ride the pneumatic Honda finally. The pneumatic engine Honda was given to. So Pedrosa stayed on the spring valve, and Hayden got the pneumatic valve one that he's been asking for, and he was very happy with it after the qualifying session. He was fourth, which he's obviously qualified better before, but. He said that the little extra power really let him ride it the way he likes to ride, which is, lighting up the wheel once in a while.
Right. Right. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that was good stuff. But since the conditions and Donington always being slippery, which, the variety of theories about that, jet exhaust or whatever, I think that factored into this race a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was kind of goofy weather. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the big tragedy of this race was because Tozan did not qualify very well. He qualified 16th. Oh, my God. I didn't even notice that before. But, yeah, he qualified horribly. And there were such huge expectations here.
A lot of pressure.
I mean, Tozan's season began on the front row of the MotoGP grid as a rookie. And I remember him, in Qatar... And kneeling in front of his bike, and he had this insanely intense look on his face. And I was like, whoa, this guy is so serious. And I think he really is a very serious guy, but possibly the pressure really got to him because he did not do well the entire weekend. He was struggling.
Got to him at Donington. Yes, yes, definitely.
Rossi did much better than him in qualifying. The only guy who on the Yamaha who didn't do it, who had a rougher time, was Lorenzo, but Lorenzo was really hurting from that concussion in Catalonia. So he lost a lot of his confidence. He even said, because remember we were talking about the fact like how we were just so surprised with Lorenzo by this point. We were just so amazed at how different his personality turned out to be once he hit the big class, because he was. We in the beginning of the season we were like, oh well, even if he crashes, he's not gonna lose his confidence. And then here he comes and he's like, man, I'm losing my confidence. So yeah, he was 17th. Right. He was on the last row. Tozan had to start from the back. So you were gonna say something?
I was gonna say Lorenzo had a great race.
He did a great race. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't want
to. Which we'll get to here in a second.
But on the first corner is where the real tragedy I think happened. I think. Tozan was trying so hard to make up for his qualifying position that he just really just overcooked it into the first corner, cold tires, weird weather, weird surface, and crashed right on the first corner. I mean, it wasn't just like he got off, fell in the dirt, and picked it back up. He was hurting, but he couldn't. Just say this is it in front of his home crowd. So he got back on the bike. He ended up riding around the track. And he did finish last. He didn't quite catch Melandri. Let's see how much he was still. I think.
My chart just says one lap. It doesn't have the exact time.
Yeah, that's right. Well, okay, race time was 45.
Yeah, looking to see if
it's
I can...
It's very strange because according to the race time, he was actually on the track less... Oh, of course. He was on the track less than Melandri, but they brought him in. He didn't get to do the last lap.
Yeah.
Right. So anyway, so he rode around in the back of the grid, and that was very painful.
Yeah,
but at the front, Stoner led corner one and never let off, and that was it. He was gone. But we had a very nice battle between Rossi and Pedrosa because they battled for pretty much the entire race. It wasn't until like the maybe last three or four laps that Pedrosa finally gave up. Pedrosa was taking advantage of a better... The Honda had a better drive out of the corners. And so in that last corner, I forget what it's called, just before the straight... He would be able to catch Rossi by the end of the straight, and then Rossi would spend a couple of next corners fighting back the position, and it was just a repeat lap after lap after lap. It was actually quite cool to watch. I don't know if you remember, I think it was like 10 laps in a row where Pedrosa would pass Rossi on the front, but by the time they got to the finish line, Rossi was leading again. Whatever it took, he did on the slower parts. And obviously, the Honda had better better drive out of the corner.
Better drive, yeah. But yeah, it was that was good stuff. It was I having been to Donington and being such an Anglophile and all that, I have a bit of a weak spot for it, so I always enjoy it.
Yeah,
and yeah, I do recall it was an excellent race.
And then at the end we had the track invasion, which this year was especially nasty because there were some riders that were still on their actual race lap when the invasion began, and as a result a couple of riders had to weave through the crowd to get back into the pits, so that was... But let's not get too down on that whole thing, but yeah, I mean that's expected at Donington,
right? And we got quite a few emails about that of mostly from English
over the last
listeners.
3 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Every time we talk about this round.
Yeah, that the shameful behavior and all that sort of thing. And it is. It's just I don't know. People get stupid. I mean, I guess granted, they're risking the riders' lives as well as their own, but at least they're not sort of running down the street setting cars on fire,
right?
Which tends to be what happened when we win basketball championships and stuff. So. Yeah.
Okay.
Been looking through this thing here, and then Hopkins retired. Do you remember off the top of your head what happened on that one?
Yeah, he had a breakdown, mechanical breakdown.
Yeah, just mechanical. There's no details that we know of. Yeah. Because Hopkins had been having a frustrating season last year, and there's just one more race that kind of proved the point, sort of a thing.
Right.
Okay.
So then we go to the Netherlands, to Assen.
Yeah.
Where once again, every single day, every single session, it was all about Stoner. And let's see, qualifying. So we had Stoner, Pedrosa, Rossi on the front row. Hayden, again, on the second row and fourth. De Pugnay, he actually always does well at this track. Edwards, who obviously likes this track. And of course, we've got that great, 2006, going back to 2006, Hayden Edwards.
Right. And there was a lot of talk about that this last year.
Yeah, obvious reasons. And then Lorenzo came back and he ended up on third row. So he's starting to pick up his confidence after the good finish at Donington. Let's go back to Donington just really quickly. So because we had Stoner winning the race, Rossi did take second and Pedrosa third. There was not that much movement in the championship standings. Rossi was still way ahead, Pedrosa. But Stoner now passed
Lorenzo.
Stoner
caught up a lot, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
He made a lot of ground back. He was still, what is that? Is that
he was,
30-something odd points behind
Pedrosa,
but I...
But 44 or 45 points behind Rossi, so that's still...
Right.
Quite a distance, but he did catch and pass Lorenzo.
Exactly. And that started sealing the deal on Lorenzo being a contender.
Right.
At that point.
Yep.
So, but yeah, it's still. So, yeah, Assen, good qualifying performance for Fabian Milan up there on the third row.
Uh-huh.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah, a lot of people that got hurt. So they, even though they qualified, they didn't get to start the race. Hopkins and Caparossi and those are the
only Caparossi two guys didn't even start. Qualify officially. Yeah,
he didn't. Right. But Hopkins broke his leg, and he was actually out for this race, Germany, and Laguna Seca, which is of course for him quite a tragedy. His home race.
Exactly.
His first home race, anyway.
Yeah, and here at Assen, we had are we ready to start talking about the race, or?
Yeah, so let's talk about the race. So we had quite kind of a reversal of fortune here, I guess, because on the first lap, I think the first guy out was not actually Rossi and
Depinier.
Depinier. There was somebody that crashed before. I think was it DeAngelis?
DeAngelis and Depinier both crashed on the first lap, and I think
DeAngelis actually crashed before Depinier, and of course then Depinier crashed and Rossi went down. Everybody was of course blaming Depinier, but it turned out after a replay that it was totally Rossi's fault. Rossi was trying to he had a very poor start, and he was trying to make up for it, and he took out René Depinier.
Right, in a sort of odd twist of reversal of roles,
right?
If you want to call it that. Actually, on the time though, and I think we talked about this at the time. The official times here has Rossi and Depinier crashing out at 2:01 and 12 seconds, and DeAngelis crashing out at 2:01 and 54 seconds. But
you may be right. You may be right. Actually, you know what? DeAngelis, you're right. DeAngelis did crash later, and he actually caused like a whole bunch of mayhem on the track.
Okay. Yeah.
I think like West and somebody else got caught up in his crash. We actually had very few people. a much smaller number of people finish this race than usual. I mean, it was not a wet race, but yet we only had like 13 finishers.
Right. Well, a relatively small grid, 17 rider grid. That was one of the, we're starting to see the wow, fewer than 18, the kind of a thing, and that was a bit of a deal.
Yeah, it was only 16 guys that actually got to the track, to the starting grid, because Hopkins was out. So there was a hole there in the grid.
Exactly. So, yeah, even though Hopkins had a qualifying time, right? Small field, and Rossi and Depinier had that crash, but Rossi managed to rejoin the race, and
he did sell some points. He ended up coming in 11th, which is 4 points.
Right.
Four.
There was something. I think it is off the.
No, it's 5 points. 5 points. Wait.
5 points. Was something broken on his motorcycle at this race too, or was that? Am I thinking of something else?
You're probably thinking back to like the Jerez 2006
race. The crazy one, yeah.
The crazy one.
Yeah. But it seems like, right. Rossi, though, can often make a motorcycle that would, be unrideable for many people, and he can still go out there and at least do respectably well. And it's always amazing.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is that if you look at the difference in the finishing, I mean, he basically caught the guys that he could catch. The rest of the guys were just way, way too far ahead. I think basically the guys he caught, he was able to catch were the guys who got caught up with the DeAngelis crash. And West also crashed later on. I'm not sure if it was before or after Rossi got past him.
Yeah, it was... here's that's Rossi. A good question. I don't know.
Yeah, he crashed way before Rossi would have passed him. Actually, Wes was having a good race. Wes was up to like 11th place. Unfortunately, didn't work out. So, up front, it was pretty boring. Stoner Pedrosa, blah. But what happened in third? That was the crazy, crazy bit. Because we had Edwards, who started off in sixth. And he's good at this track. He got up as high as fourth. He was not going to catch Hayden. There was just no way he was going to catch Hayden. Hayden had a very good fat lead on him. everyone remembers 2006, where we had this crazy battle between Hayden and Colin Edwards, who were both fighting for their first win back then. That was before... Oh, sorry. Actually, that's not true, because Hayden already had won the 2005 Laguna Seca. But Edwards was fighting for his first win. Hayden was fighting for his first win of that season. And it was a fantastic battle. But on the very last, that last chicane, which is a very tricky section, they both went off, but Hayden kind of hung on. He went off earlier and actually, I think, got the best of it, because that part of the track is a little less... he basically crossed the curb in a on a perpendicular angle, whereas Colin, he climbed up the curb. He tried to climb up the curb and lost the back spinning and crashed and ended up 13th. He probably would have won the race otherwise. So yeah. In a kind of reversal of fortune again, Hayden actually ran out of gas, I think 100 feet from the finish line.
And he was pounding the tank.
He was slowing down and he was going, oh crap. And then he realized that he actually could still roll over the line before Edwards, because it was far enough behind. So he actually still tucked, but he was really rolling at like 40 miles an hour, and Edwards Edwards passed him, and then Hayden did roll across the line just immediately afterwards.
Right. What was the official gap? Was actually the official gap was pretty big. It was
just 3 seconds.
3 seconds difference, yeah. So yeah, Hayden coasted across.
But Hayden was coasting.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So, yeah.
I do remember that, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that was a frustrating thing, because Hayden was, again, on the pneumatic valve bike at this race.
Right, and actually, and I forgot to mention, back in Donington, he was doing very good times, and then he looked like something went wrong. And what actually happened was that a warning light came on in the cockpit, and he... So he was like trying to figure out what was up, and he never really found out. And the same light went on during this race as well. And
I think it's low fuel light.
I think it's some kind of electronic, you know, doobie. That's like maybe some computer that was not quite like happy with the information that it was getting, and it was not sure whether it was giving accurate information about the fuel load or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because I remember having a conversation about, that we're going to go way back to the 2005 season with Seth Gibernau at Brno.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where he ran out of gas going up the hill in the last lap after Rossi passed him. But I really feel he basically took the chessboard and knocked the pieces off the table, because he was so pissed that he was going to lose. Because basically, it's almost impossible for those bikes to run out of fuel. I thought at the time because
back then they had the what 22 liters.
Yeah, 22 liters, but not only that, but they already had like the computer that actually was doling out the fuel, and according to some insiders, Honda was just really all over, like, we're just not going to run out of fuel. And they were perfect. Like, you know, they'll run out of fuel in the cool down lap, but never in the race. Well, something definitely didn't work out that way at Assen, and Nicky ran out literally like inside of the finish line.
What that, and that is, though, that what's due, we figured, to the pneumatically valved engine, something about the fuel consumption, and there's just something going on with it, at least during those races.
Right.
Basically, it's a little thirstier. And 21 liters, was last year the first year for the 21 liters, or was the year before?
I don't think they lowered it last year. I think it was
last year. But in any case, the reduced fuel load is just, it's not quite enough. You know, it's just, it's so close. And also they clamped down on some of the trickery that had been occurring in the past of chilling the fuel and stuff like that.
Right. Right.
Because the official rule is something like basically the fuel can't be, you know, semi-frozen anymore when they fill the bikes up.
Yep.
And I can't remember the exact wording of the rule, but there's some way or another that they have it. So yeah, exactly. It's Edwards managed to nip Hayden there on the last lap.
That was Hayden's first chance to be on the podium, I believe, this year. He hadn't been on the podium yet. So
yeah.
So it was really crushing. because Hayden, I mean, Ed was already was on the podium in France. Okay, so that was Assen.
We lost
Hopkins for the next few races, next few rounds. That was a bummer.
Yeah.
I mean, his season was miserable, miserable. The only person I think who was more miserable was Melandri, because he was
Marco Melandri. Yes.
He wasn't hurting himself, but he was still last.
Yeah, okay. I'm thinking Anthony West was probably also not the happiest rider out there, but I think the expectations for both Hopkins and Melandri were much higher.
Yes,
and
I mean
and
their own
particularly
personal
Melandri. I mean,
you're saying their personal expectations, not expectations of them, but expectations that they had.
Yeah, at both, actually. Don't you think? I mean, I expected...
I never
thought that Anthony West was going to be a big contender to be beating Marco Melandri every race.
Yeah, you know? And I didn't think that Hopper made the right choice. I didn't think Kawasaki was going to be a great bike. So I wasn't expecting him to... I would have been really happy to see him, like, finish in the top 10.
Right. Well,
That's as much as I was expecting. Whereas with Melandri, I was expecting him on the Ducati to win a couple races.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, this is true. And I mean, I think we talked about it. And we were saying that, you know, Hopkins could probably podium.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, we were wrong.
Yeah, way wrong. Way, way, way wrong. But,
that bike last year, the Kawasaki, was horrible.
Yeah, it was. They had a lot of problems going on. And poor old Hopper basically went out there and just tried to he overrode the motorcycle. You know what I'm saying? He's like, wringing every last little bit that he could out of it. And it wasn't enough. And he ended up hurting himself. And we had talked earlier when he moved from Suzuki to Kawasaki, and, you know, in a nutshell, that it was so much just for the money and all of that and the reasons, and, you know, just that it was a shame. It was sad to see.
That's why you can't have your mom be a manager.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, you know, I can't say in the same position, you know, somebody's waving around big, giant bags of money like that. You know, I might do the same thing. You know, me now, yes, I would, because I'm 42 and fat and all of that. You know, it's like, yeah, I'll go out there and ride
$2 million a year. Okay, sure. Yeah,
I'll ride a WCM with, you know, the R1 engine. But you know what I'm saying? Is that, you know, he made the wrong decision. He really did.
Yeah, yeah.
He should have stayed at Suzuki. And now it's even more so. You know, John, you should have given me a call. Yeah. You should have asked my opinion, you know.
Yeah. We have really excellent hindsight over here.
Oh, yes. Yes, we're the best. Yeah. Hindsight is always 20/20 on MotoGP OD. All right.
So we're up to Germany.
Shall we move on to Germany?
Yeah.
The Alice Motorrad Grand Prix. I always like that. Motorrad Grand Prix Deutschland.
It's a track that I think has been on the cutting board many, 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 many times because it's just weird for MotoGP. It's almost all left, and it's pretty slow overall. But I like it.
I've got
really
some interesting
like it.
Parts. It's not my favorite, though.
It's not my favorite, but it's my one of my favorite races. Actually, took place at that track. It was 2006. I think that was the one where Kenny Roberts and Tamada like took each other out. But he was doing really well, and Rossi came from like 11th and ended up winning the race. And it was just really fun race to watch. And the laps are really short. It's a good lead-in, actually, to the Laguna Seca, because it's kind of, same kind of like twisty. You never really get a chance to just breathe. They have a straight, but it's pretty short. I guess the Laguna Seca straight is worse because there really is no straight in Laguna Seca.
It's not really straight, exactly, yeah. and you know, in all of that at Laguna Seca. And on the Omega turn is a somewhat of a signature turn. Even it's nothing like the corkscrew as far as the turn is concerned.
Right.
But that's what I always think of when I think of Sachsenring, is I think of that Omega turn.
Yeah, 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 where you plunge down the hill.
Right. Yeah. And it's shaped like the Greek letter Omega. It's a weird turn. I can't say it's ever been, you know, I wouldn't be all that sad if they moved the German Grand Prix somewhere else.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. It would be good to try another track. I agree. But I do like, I've never disliked races at this track. So.
No. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. That makes sense.
Again, Stoner qualified first. He was looking extremely well throughout the thing.
And it was his weekend all weekend long. Again, on that one, if I do recall, practice sessions, everything. He was just – it was the Stoner show.
But you got to remember, Pedrosa won this race in 2007. And he'd qualified second. So the only issue was that it was pouring. And as everybody knows, Pedrosa has a reputation for not being the best wet weather rider. Although by this time he already proved himself that he can hold his own. But I guess a lot of questions still remained. And
along with his fear of things to his right, his actual phobia, supposedly.
That's right. That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Which I still think is BS, but you never know.
And then, Rossi did not have a good time at this track. He qualified on the third row. Lorenzo, again, decent qualifying. Depugne, decent qualifying. Depugne always seems to do well in practice and qualifying, and then either crashes or... I mean, even when he doesn't crash, he doesn't do that well. He just, I don't know.
Might be one of
the... I just don't get the hold of the Pugnay thing, actually. I don't understand it.
I agree. But on the other hand, qualifying, you tend to be a bit more by yourself. You can be. You can break away from the traffic and all of that, and you can't do it in a race. That might have something to do with it. Nobody to take out. But yeah, he does. He tends to qualify better than he finishes, if he finishes.
Right. So the race started in full wet. And the big story, I think, was that Michelin fucked up.
Yes, this was the first of those three Michelin races in a row where they just got it so wrong, right?
And this is I mean, nobody could have predicted it then, but this was the beginning of the end of a tire competition in MotoGP.
Right. This is true because at this point, I mean, even longtime Michelin poster children like Colin Edwards were out in the press saying that Michelin screwed this up.
Yeah, I think I remember. I don't know if it was at this race or at Laguna that Edwards was like talking after.
He got really bad at Laguna. Yeah,
what's that?
Yeah, and he got really bad at Laguna.
Well, he was gonna be funny about it. He was like saying, "Well, maybe by the time we get on the race, I mean he qualified well. He's always been saying." Michelin has the best qualifying tire, and that's end of story. But he was struggling during the practices, and I think he said at one of the practices, it was like, "Well, we'll probably figure out something by, we'll do this, we'll do that." And I'm just talking out of my ass. There's nothing we can do. It was like this common, like typical Colin Edwards like moment of clarity. And sure enough, the Michelin guys were screwed.
Yeah, it was brutal.
The Vizioso kind of saved the day for them, but other than him, it was horrible.
I know, I'm looking down the list right now myself. Yeah, exactly. Dovizioso, top Michelin finisher in fifth place. A bit of an anomaly there. I mean, you qualified fourth, finished fifth. Yeah. Great performance by Dovizioso. Yeah.
Well, he was pretty much fourth, fifth rider. The entire season was amazing.
Right. Yeah, this is true. But beyond more than we expected.
Yeah.
That's why I say it's a bit of an anomaly. That JIR team Scott, which had been, the previous year, was a terrible team. And, Dovizioso, by taking along his own people and the things that he did and everything, he did so well on that. It was a different team than it had been the previous year. So you can't really, it's a bit apples and oranges. But I was surprised.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did super well, and I think that shows a lot of his talents as a rider.
So Rossi was starting further down, which was Stoner up front. This was like heaven for him, obviously.
Right.
But what happened during the race was kind of unfreaking believable. Which was Danny Pedrosa and Stoner both had the quality of like when they get in front and they get the rhythm, they can really break the field. But And I've watched this race. I ended up watching this race like I think three different times, like the speed version, the Eurosport version, and some other version. And everyone was saying the same thing. Like they were looking at the timesheets, and they were just like, after four laps, I think Pedrosa was leading the race by like 7 seconds, you know, and like he would be exiting the straight when Stoner, who was chasing it, was just entering the straight. The gap was unbelievable, and we were only like an eighth into the race or something like that. Because this is a very long race.
He did. He stepped it. He stepped it way, way out. Yeah, a lot of laps.
So you know he was out there, and he was on the Michelins, but on lap six, at the beginning of lap six, at the very end of the straight, Danny Pedrosa had a crash. It didn't look like it was going to be a nasty crash, but he just kept going. And if you look at the footage of this afterwards, like I remember during the crash, it didn't look like it was that particularly nasty. But looking at the footage afterwards, it was brutal. He really got spun around, and that bike, the way it hit the air fence, and
was
almost
that the
landed
one where
on him.
It hit the air fence and it was like 8 feet above his
yeah,
head?
Yeah, it was just crazy, yeah. crazy. And yeah, he
that
ended
picture
up getting
was
very hurt.
Yeah.
So he actually ended up, he did show up at Laguna Seca, but he didn't race there. He tried the first few
practices. He didn't even go out on Saturday, did he? He went out Friday and
Michelin was still having problems, so he was like, this is not worth it. So
right, exactly.
So Danny Pedrosa, who was way up there in the championship standings, was suddenly taken out and gave the lead in the race to Stoner. There was no way Stoner was going to catch him if Pedrosa was able to keep up that pace. No way.
Right. Much of a gap after a few laps, yeah.
He was doing 2 seconds. He was going 2 seconds faster than anybody else on the track. Just unbelievable. Rossi then cost kind of in third. So the rest of the race was actually pretty boring because the I guess the third place was fun between Vermeulen.
But you didn't see a lot of it on camera, did we? I mean, that one was that Vermeulen.
They did start showing it like in the last couple of laps. They always do that where like where it's obvious that the guys in front are right. solid, and they'll break to the battle. So we did get to see a little bit of the Divizio. I mean the Angelis and Vermeulen battle. It would have been nice to see the Angelis on the podium, but we. Rainmaster got him, even if he hates to be called the Rainmaster. But we lost a lot of people in this race. We lost Edwards, who was, I think, running in fifth at the time. And if you look at actually like how far back the next guy was, Divizioso, behind De Angelis.
It was an enormous gap. It was almost
it was like
30 seconds. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, 30 seconds. Yeah, 30 seconds. Yeah. And then Guntuli had a great ride, which was actually kind of interesting because this was the race where Dantin left the team.
It was
this weekend that they announced that Dantin was leaving.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it was before or after, actually.
Or
I don't quite remember.
During.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. That was kind of weird news. Yeah, exactly.
That's very weird news. So anyway, the standings at the end of the so again, Stoner got this one handed to him, but he was very strong all weekend, so he deserved it. Bridgestone definitely deserved it; they got it right. Michelin did
right. He somewhat got it gifted, but I think he earned the gift.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It was
And suddenly he's only 20 points behind Rossi. That's a race.
Right. You know? Exactly. And I think Rossi saw the writing on the wall there at that point.
Right.
You know, too.
Oh yeah.
Bit of a wake up call.
Yep. Which is why the next. Time we talk about the next part of the season, we're going to be talking about
things get really exciting.
What Rossi really had to do,
yes,
to win this championship, and that's what made this such an incredibly interesting part of the season.
Right. But yeah, for results for the race: Stoner won, Rossi second, 3.7 seconds back. Chris Vermeulen on the podium, because he's the Rainmaster.
Yep,
narrowly nipping out De Angelis. And Vermeulen, yes, by far his best performance thus far in this season. Because I think he had a fifth in France. I think he did.
Okay.
And I'm looking at the point things. And other than that, you know, it's so that was good for him. But, okay. Silvan Guattoli, as far as a rider, Silvan, go ahead.
You go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, Silvan Guattoli is I mean, you know, okay, we've speculated for a long time. The main reason that Randy Dupuis has his seat and everything is because French, and they do. They want to make it a world championship, so you got to have a nice sprinkling of riders. And, you know, especially when, at least up until this year, you know, one of the two tire manufacturers and all that is a French company, and there's a fair amount of French involvement. So, you know, you've got to have a French rider, right? I would, if I was the guy that says I'm going to hire a Frenchman, I'd go with Guintoli over Dupuis any day of the week.
Totally, yeah. Totally.
And you know, I think he's done very, very well on. I mean, I don't want to call him second rate motorcycles, but you know, when he was with Tech 3, I think he did pretty well, and I think he did pretty well on Alice, which was last year was definitely not a second rate motorcycle, but I think you can make the argument that in 2007. The Tech 3 bike certainly was.
Right.
You know,
right,
not
right,
the motorcycle, right. But the tires were.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And oddly enough, the French guy's riding on the English tires. But, you know, so yeah, and I'm not, he's one of the guys where it's a little bit like, you know, while I think Guintoli lost out on the musical chairs game.
He did, but I think he's going to do fine in World Superbikes. And,
yeah, he should do all right.
And that'll be fun to watch.
Yeah. Where the old MotoGP riders go to die.
He's a very young guy, so he may be back. We'll
see. Never know. Yeah, it could happen.
So, speaking of which, so before we wrap the show up, Portimao had the test this last week, mm-hmm. So that was really fun to watch those results. Shaky Byrne, man. And Stiligarda Ducati. Wow.
Yeah.
He just owned that weekend.
He's another guy who's I don't think he's been in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Should, you know, I mean, in a lot of ways, I think Byrne is an excellent, excellent rider. And it's just sort of not the right place at the right time kind of a situation is the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
You know, to because he's always done so well in British Superbike.
But the guy that I think, I mean, I was amazed was Spies. I mean, Spies, I think, was third overall.
Yeah,
maybe even second.
At Portimao. Yeah,
yeah.
I didn't really study the results. I barely read the headlines.
And you know, I have to say, like I would not like on a MotoGP bike. I think Spies has like a season of learning before him. You can't just. I think that basically transferring from AMA to World Superbike is like a no brainer. He just has to learn the tracks. I mean, he can race those kinds of motorcycles all the way to the edge, and Speed is really good at that. And so I think he's going to be a contender in the World Superbike Championship.
Yeah. I mean, the Pirellis might give him a bit of a small issue and everything, but apparently not too much of an issue. You know, I mean, he seemed to be able to adapt to jumping around on different tires.
I mean, Shaky Byrne was incredible because he's never been in this track either. It's a brand new track. Mm-hmm. And only the guys who had raced there from last season really got to experience it so far. So the fact that Shaky was able to own that place right from get-go was pretty insane. I mean, Haga was struggling the first day or two. And they got every kind of weather, too. They had, like, wet days and dry days. So they really got to push those bikes around in different kinds of situations. So we got to see, I think... I didn't get to see any of the riding, unfortunately.
America was there anywhere totally that was broadcast? Off. I mean, did you?
I'm sure Eurosport was showing it in Europe, somewhere. But yeah. I haven't seen it. So,
right. It's pathetic. But yeah, and the World Superbikes is probably looking at a pretty good season this year.
The grid, it's like a 31 bikes?
I know. 31 bikes, huge grid, a lot of talent.
Yeah.
A lot of different makes. Xerox
Ducatis should be super exciting if he can. I mean, he did finally kind of get his times up, but he was struggling a bit.
Yeah, new bike to him and all of that.
Yeah,
You know, back again on the Ducati.
It's a different Ducati, though. And
exactly.
And they have that weird qualifying format now, right? I don't quite understand it. Do you know what?
I haven't even read up, and I was just going to say what we're...
It's like a knockout thing where I don't quite get the rules. I haven't really read them, so...
Me neither. And so much of World Superbike qualifying, I mean, what with Super Pole and all of that, it's always been a bit weird anyway.
I never liked Super Pole. No. At all? I mean,
it's designed for the advertisers. It's a way to get the
Exactly. And
which is fine. Money pays the bills, blah blah blah. But I've never paid that much attention to World Superbike qualifying.
It's too much luck, I thought.
Yeah. And also, you know, I've never liked the whole concept of a doubleheader every single weekend, so a guy qualifies and then that sets his grid for two races. True.
Right.
Yeah. And he could totally hose one up, but okay, then now the next second race, he's still, you know, front row or whatever he qualified. And I never liked that much.
Yeah. One qualifying for two races. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if qualifying is traditionally like, let's make sure that the fast guys are up front and the slow guys are in the back, because we want to make sure that the slow guys don't screw up the fast guys. But it's never actually been that way for 80 years of racing. So
it's always difficult. I mean, there's so many different ways you can set the grid. I was just going to say, except when they invert, those series where they invert the grid.
Right, exactly.
Which is what are you trying to do here? And what an invitation for tanking.
Right.
Oh, wow, I had a terrible qualifying section, but look, I'm in the front row. So I've never... It makes sense in like club racing and I guess at that level,
the reverse thing?
Hobbyist. Yeah, inverting the grid.
Yeah, but I think they invert it based on race results, not on qualifying. Because then you'd be like, oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm going slow.
But do they always? I mean, yeah. And then you've got other series where it's like, you qualified on the front of the grid or whatever. You know, here's a brick to carry along with you.
That's stuff like that.
So, you know. It's qualifying. It's a necessary evil of racing, but because you have to figure out somehow or another how you're going to arrange these people. There's always something about it that you can complain about. You know, I think actually,
in MotoGP, a reversed grid from the previous race would kind of be interesting.
It'd be super interesting. You know? And I mean, those times that we've had where like rain races and things like that have virtually inverted the field.
Yeah.
I've always been really interesting, but if you do that every time, sooner or later, you're asking for somebody to, have to get a motorcycle ectomy out of his, anus because you just can't do that.
And not only but it would get gamed. It would get gamed.
Yeah,
people would
be
figuring out, okay, well, I'm not totally good at this track, but the next track I'm really good at, so I'm going to suck at this track.
Right. Right. You know? I mean, the fairest way is the way we do it in MotoGP, where you go out there and go as fast as you can, where you go.
Minus the qualifying tire, which they are getting rid of. So I think that
I've always liked your tires.
Nah. But, yeah. I mean, why? Why? I mean, like,
I don't know. It maybe lends it to the fact that now the tire manufacturers have their competition. And yes, okay, Michelin was better than Bridgestone. I don't know.
Fair. That's a good point. I think it's a shame that they took that rule out after it became a single tire series, because they should have just got rid of qualifying tires. They should have said, I don't know how you'd do that, but
well,
I guess less.
You could just, here's your truckload of tires and you shuffle them around and say, these ones are you going to use to qualify and these ones you're going to use in the race, that kind of thing.
Right.
But
that's true.
Yeah. Where somebody, some blind, tire passer outer guy, it determines it. But I see your point as well, that the qualifying tire idea is a bit, a bit silly, I guess, is what you'd say. It's not pure, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. There's so many ways, like you say, so many ways that you can game the system that no matter what, and that's how the rule makers have to be one step ahead of the rule breakers, right? Because even if you're following the letter of the law, you may not necessarily be paying any attention to the spirit of the law. And that's where, if we're going to sort of try to keep things on a level-ish playing field, which is what the rules are all about, that you have to come up with new ones that defeat those people that are outthinking you.
Right, right.
On the other hand, it keeps everybody on their toes.
Yeah, and the rule book keeps growing.
Yeah, this is true too. And I have said that I like the MotoGP. You know, here's your rule book, and it's, you know, like 4 pages thick. You know, it's very, very skimpy.
Yeah. I actually have one that was being carried around by Alicia, because Liam gave me one in 2007. It's just so thin. I mean, like the
it is. It's
the,
very the, small.
The doping rules are bigger than the entire technical and rider. Rules. It's amazing.
You can download these on the FIM website, folks. If you want to take a look at the rules, and they are. There's really not a lot to them. It's real. There's more text and verbiage about the anti-doping stuff, and about things like how the tracks must run an event. You know, is covered in great detail.
Right, that's right.
Number of porta potties for each, you know, attendee, and all of this kind of thing. It broken down by male and female, and all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And then the motorcycle is like, you know, well, you can't use these certain kind of metal, and you have to be, and it's got to weigh this much.
There are some funny rules in there. Like, one rule that I looked up at the end of that Assen race in 2006 that we were talking about earlier is they actually have this. The driver of the motorcycle has to be touching the motorcycle when it crosses the finish line for it to count.
Oh, is that one too?
It has to be in contact. I was thinking, like, well, what would happen if his Yamaha had actually rolled across the finish line by itself?
Right. On the other hand, though, that, you know, you could be you know, running alongside that motorcycle and pushing it and still win.
Yes. Yeah, right. As long as you're touching it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. But I think that's fair. If you have fallen off before the finish line.
Of course. Of course.
That's reasonable.
So speaking of rules, there's been actually quite a bit of, not news, but just opinions from various sources like Dennis Noyes and Kropotkin, and all those guys have had some really great articles in the last week or two about the cost of MotoGP because, you know, of the Kawasaki disaster. And pretty much everybody's coming up to this with the same conclusion, which is that the rule changes is what it's costing. All the rule changes that were designed to lower costs, supposedly, and promote safety have backfired both on the safety thing, as we've discussed many times, and it turns out on the costing. And it really makes sense. I mean, we've been saying this for a while on the show, but it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, like how that actually works out. But the reality is, if you have to constantly be changing the spec of the motorcycle every couple of years, it's tremendous amounts of money. I mean, the R&D costs are huge.
Right, and Formula One blog had comments on the same thing, that you say, all of a sudden you say, okay, we're going to make a rule, the engine has to last so many races.
Yeah.
And that'll reduce costs. No, because they just spend a whole bunch of money on making an engine more reliable.
Right.
You know?
Which has good benefits, but if you're just going for costs.
It has great benefits, but it's still, if you're, why don't you say that the purpose of the rule is that, I don't know, you know, that we want to make engines more reliable, right. You know, instead of saying, you know, we're going to reduce costs by this. Because no matter what, the people with the money are going to spend the money. So unless you have some sort of thing that actually controls how much money they spend, and even that, how do you control that? You know, that engineer's working for a dollar a year.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Jerry Burgess. Yeah, he's going to take a dollar for the whole year. Yeah.
Right. And it's a little bit of a pipe dream to pass all of these rules that you say are designed to cut costs. I mean, I guess there's...
And the reality is, if you look back at 2005, 2004, we had privateer teams. We had WCM in 2003. We had Team KR for a bunch of years with us. Right. And
Elmore gave it a shot.
Elmore gave it a shot, exactly. Mm-hmm. Elmore gave it a shot even after the formula changed, which I thought was amazing.
They tried.
They really thought
they could make a go of it, you know, and all of that.
But obviously, it was the cost that killed them. They were just like, well, we're not going to...
They had an 800cc engine. They were racing the 800cc engine against 990cc motorcycles.
That's right.
And, you know, with some more money and development time and everything, they might have been able to go out there and make a decent showing of things. But, you know, the lack of sponsorship and et cetera, they just, you know, failed.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just a funny parallel, like, to everything else that's been going on in the world. It's like everybody's been... the costs have been rising, and all of a sudden there's a huge crash, and everybody's suffering, and you know, there's layoffs, and there's layoffs in MotoGP. You know, Kawasaki is the first victim, but I don't think it's going to end there.
I don't think it's going to end there, no. And if you wanted to have a series that you're keeping the cost down in, and you're making it where more low-end guys can participate and do okay, you have to have a set of rules like NASCAR has, where you're dumbing down the technology to this shade tree 1950s mechanic, right?
Right.
You're still going to get the Toyotas and the whatever the big names are, where they can throw more money at the problem and they will win races. Mm-hmm. But you can have the guy that is literally on a comparative shoestring budget go out there and maybe he's just a rolling speed bump, but if that's what you want, if that's the kind of racing you want, then you've achieved it. That, you know, somebody can go out there on a relatively small budget. But at the top level of racing and stuff, you're not going to get it to be something that's, you know, super cheap, where you put a mortgage on the house and let's go racing. You know, it's just, it costs a lot more money than that.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was watching the race at Dakar with Charlie Borman. I actually haven't seen that particular series. It's good. It's a good series. But what made me, it made me realize that, but actually, it was not that. It was really started with Long Way Down. When they were showing that, I realized, you know, this is kind of ridiculous. These guys are going down. They've invested huge amounts of money into these motorcycles and like the support vehicles, whatever. And then they like run into like this couple while they were riding down to Africa. They were ran into a couple who've been like running around on, like, you know, KLMs or something like that. And they're doing the same trip, you know.
Dutch couple that were on like a Honda 350 or something crazy, and they did like for 15 years they were riding around. Yeah, exactly.
Or that guy that they ran into like on some weird dirt road who was on a bicycle, like this. He was pulling a trailer, and I'm pedaling around the world. I'm gonna, you know, go to. I think he's going to go up. He was coming back from South Africa, and he was going to go across to Japan and like take a paddle boat or something. He was going to actually paddle boat to Australia or something insane.
Oh my gosh!
But that's beyond, like, the Dakar guys. Even like the privateer teams, they spend a lot of money. But the amount of money that these guys put into for that show, and only have one, you know, like. Basically, their result was that one guy ended up finishing at least. But, I mean, we're talking like $1 million, you know?
Yeah. Well, anything, as soon as it, you know, you start getting it on TV and everything, the money, and money corrupts, and lots of money corrupts lots. Mm-hmm. I mean, to paraphrase the quote, it just is the way life is. And to wish it otherwise is fantasy land.
So. I want to be in the fantasy land, Bob.
You're not going to be in the fantasy land, Jules. Fantasy land, I mean, you can go out there and you can club race and you can do it. Jim Race said it several years ago. If you want to see good racers, you watch MotoGP. If you want to see good racing, you go to club race.
Yeah.
And he's
right. That's so true. It's totally
but even
true.
A club race, you know, there's that guy that's got, I don't know, he's a lawyer.
Oh, no. Or they have sponsors. They do have sponsors in these races.
Sure, they have sponsors. And the guy that has the more sponsorship money, or the guy that's willing to spend more of his own money, mm-hmm. or whatever, tends to do well.
Yep.
You know, it's just, it's money. It takes a lot of money. It's not a cheap sport.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think you could pretty much say that for almost any sport these days.
This is true.
Even pure physical sports like, you know, running.
Sure. Because how much time do you have? Do you have a regular day job, or do you go out and just run all day? Yeah. And how much can you spend on drugs? How much can you spend on shoes? How much can you spend on fancy running gear? You know, these things will make you better.
Well, you know, the Kenyans still win the marathon, so there's hope.
There you go. Even though they probably have sponsors.
Yeah, so, they do.
So, all right. Well, so there we go.
That's a good tangent.
Yes, it was an excellent tangent. I thought it was super interesting. And that's the end of the stoner...
Surge. The stoner surge is working.
Good going, Bob. Totally forgot the name of the show. The surge. We all know the surge works. They did it a few years ago in Iraq. The surge. And look, it's great. Iraq's like this peaceful paradise now.
Right. So,
but all right, Jules, it was good stuff. Next week, we're going to come back and we're going to talk more.
And we're going to talk about the most exciting race in a long, long freaking time.
And that's only because you and I were there. I mean, otherwise, you know, it would have just been one more race in the whole year, right? You know, no. It was so cool to be there because it was so exciting. And I'm jumping up and down, and oh, it was awesome.
It's going to be fun talking about it. I'm looking forward to it already.
It will. And what other races do we want to cover next week? We're going to talk about Laguna Seca.
The whole, like, you know, Rossi takes over kind of thing, where we're going to go through to Bassano.
Yep. So we're going to go, Laguna Seca, Brno in Czechoslovakia after a long summer break, and then Misano,
yep.
In San Marino officially.
Yep. And, I think we'll do Indy too. I don't know. There's this interesting overlap because
Indy kind of falls into both. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we should do Indy
because that means we've got four races in two shows rather than, you know, one of three and then one of five.
Right. Or however. Let's do it that way. Even though those last couple were boring, but okay.
Cool. Yeah, you got to talk about them somehow or another.
Yep.
We're doing a season review, Jules. We're not picking and choosing.
Cool.
So, unless we did a third show where we said the boring couple, you know. All right. Sounds good. And I will talk to you again very, very soon, Jules.
All right. Ciao.
That's going to do it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Jules and I have been having fun talking about last season and rehashing stuff. Next week, we're going to do part four of that season review, and we're going to cover the United States Grand Prix at Laguna Seca, the Czech Grand Prix at Brno, Republic of San Marino at Misano, and the Indianapolis Grand Prix at Indianapolis. And so the next four races there, we're going to talk about next week. I'm not 100% sure what we're going to call that one. Jules has been sort of coming up with these cool names, Rossi Resurgence and Stoner Surge and all of that, and I didn't catch what he's going to call this one. But the races of 2008 did kind of fit neatly into these little sort of compartments where we had a Lorenzo show and all of that. So we're going to talk about those next four races, and then we're going to finish it up in 2 weeks with the last four races of 2008. And that should be good stuff. Get you guys all wired up and prepped and everything, because like I said, we are getting closer and closer every minute to the 2009 season. Can't wait. So check out those links I told you about earlier on in the show. Speedfiends.com. Thanks very much, guys. Do appreciate it. The motorcycle store, if you need any gear or anything like that, take a look there. Power Sport Dynamic. That's Rexine Wall, her husband, Bob, there in Springfield, Oregon. Have a great motorcycle shop. And they're also doing a really, really cool chalet deal at Laguna Seca and I believe at Indy. And Pole Position Travel. That's Gordon Howe. And he does packages everywhere in the world, including Laguna Seca. So in that way, I guess Rexine and Gordon are somewhat sort of competing for your attentions. But check it out. Decide which kind of package you want to go with and everything else. It's going to be really, really good stuff. And I don't know about you, but I can't wait. It's getting there. It's getting soon. Weather's getting warmer, and it's about time to start some MotoGP racing. But until then, we've still got a few more weeks to go through. We're going to be getting through those. Here on MotoGPOD, we'll be talking about the rest of the 2008 season. We're going to be talking about some other stuff. We're going to have some exciting shows coming up in the next few weeks. And so until then, keep the rubber side down and the shiny set up, and we will talk to you later. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.